Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
From the Jill Schwartz Memorial Library here in sultry Savannah, Georgia, this is Obscure Season 4 in American Tragedy. I am your host, your friend, your ear lover, and literary mansplainer-in-chief, Michael Ian Black, speaking to you today in some discomfort. I threw out my back a couple of days ago, and as a kid, I never understood that expression, and I guess I still don't quite understand the expression, throwing out one's back, because the process of me going from able-bodied to utterly immobile, it really, there's no throwing involved. In my case, it was standing. I just stood up from the chair and then immediately had to go to my knee because I found myself in such tremendous pain as my back just kind of exploded, lower back, and it's sort of radiating down, sometimes just my right hip, sometimes my left and my right hip, and then it kind of goes away during the day, and then at night, particularly if I've been lying on the couch, it comes back, but lying on the couch is how I find myself most comfortable, so it's a little bit of a conundrum there. Now look, this isn't the first time I've thrown up my back. It happens, oh, I don't know, infrequently, but it happens, you know, every couple of years or so. So I can't really blame it on old age or impending decrepitude or anything of this sort. It is just one of those annoying human things that happens every now and again. You try to stand up, and the next thing you know, you're taking yourself a knee. It is a good excuse, though, for when you don't want to move. And of course, I so rarely do wish to move, but it's unusual for me to have as good an excuse as I do right now, which is I cannot because I am in literally crippling pain. And that would be almost certainly an exaggeration for how I am feeling, but if I was looking for an excuse, that's a pretty good one. So I'm dealing with that and made a terrific veggie lasagna last night. Yum, yum, yummy, yum. Gonna have that for dinner already. Looking forward to it. And we're not nearly at dinner time yet. I still got a couple hours until dinner time, but oh man, I'm already thinking about that lasagna. In fact, I had some for lunch. That's always a nice thing when you make something and you make a lot of it and it turns out to be good, and then you can have it every meal forever until it runs out. And I made a big pan of lasagna. And we've still got, oh, well over half of it left from last night. My God, we're going to have a good time at dinner tonight. My mouth is salivating just thinking about that. And also because I just ate a handful of pretzels and the residual salt on them is making my mouth water. Once we are at the point of the conversation where I'm telling you what I ate, it's probably time to start reading the book, because who gives a shit? Not you, almost certainly. No more than I want to hear what you had for dinner last night. So, let's get back to the story. We have been getting caught up with Clyde's comings and goings since he viciously murdered that girl 3 years before this story, 3 years before this part of the story. And of course, we know that he didn't viciously murder a girl, but if we're going to do encapsulations, we might as well make them as sordid and lurid as possible. So Clyde the Ripper basically got into a car with the intention of finding a young girl and running her over, and that's what he did. And then we took a little break and we went over to the Sam Griffiths family in Lycurgus, New York, learned a little bit about them. We learned about how the patriarch of that side of the family ran into Clyde in Chicago, presumably after Clyde wrote the old man a letter. So we're all caught up to date. The family, the rest of the family has moved on to Denver. The mother wrote him a letter basically chastising him and telling him he better shape up or he's going to hell. And, you know, that's where we are, basically. But she loves him nonetheless, and she just hopes he will do the right thing by the Lord. Okay, so that's where we are. Book 2, Chapter 22, An American Tragedy. So, mother has just written to Clyde, and her concluding line was, "Bear in mind that her love," meaning her own love, "is always with you, guiding you, pleading with you to do right in the name of the Lord." And as I was saying last time, I would be so annoyed if I got this letter, but I'd be like, "Ah, that's just crazy mom being crazy mom." But the fact is, I'm sure he was very happy to receive any missive from her, having been in hiding essentially for the last 3 years. So here we go. And so it was that Clyde had begun to think of his Uncle Samuel and his great business long before he encountered him. He had also experienced enormous relief in learning that his parents were no longer in the same financial difficulties they were when he left, and safely housed in a hotel, or at least a lodging house, probably connected with this new mission. Then, 2 months after he had received his mother's first letter, and while he was deciding almost every day that he must do something, and that forthwith, he chanced one day to deliver to the Union League Club on Jackson Boulevard a package of ties and handkerchiefs which some visitor to Chicago had purchased at the store for which he worked. Seems like a very long way to say that, but maybe not. The length and breadth of this sentence stretches for 5 complete lines. Listen to this. I'll reread it. It's a long sentence. Then, 2 months after he had received his mother's first letter, and while he was deciding almost every day that he must do something, and that forthwith, he chanced one day, etc., to deliver, etc., to some visitor to Chicago, etc., 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 for which he worked, period. Woo! Upon entering, who should he come in contact with but Ratterer? Ratterer! In the form of a club employee. He was in charge of inquiry and packages at the door. Although neither he nor Ratterer quite grasped immediately the fact that they were confronting one another again, after a moment, Ratterer had exclaimed, "Clyde!" And then, seizing him by an arm, he added enthusiastically and yet cautiously in a very low tone, "Well, of all things, the devil, what do you know? Put her there! Where do you come from anyhow?" And Clyde, equally excited, exclaimed, "Well, by jing, if it ain't Tom, what do you know? You working here?" "Well, by jing, J-I-N-G. I will say this book is full of little aphorisms of another time that I quite like. Perhaps I should have been a 1920s kid. I would have liked all that slang. By jing. Ratterer, who, like Clyde, had for the moment quite forgotten the troublesome secret which lay between them, added, because he's responding to you working here, He says, "That's right. Surest thing you know. Been here nearly a year now." Then, with a sudden pull at Clyde's arm, as much as to say, "Silence," he drew Clyde to one side, out of the hearing of the Ute to whom he had been talking as Clyde came in, and said, "Shh, I'm working here under my own name, but I'd rather not let him know I'm from KC, see?" "Oh, come on, you didn't have to do that, Tom." "I'd rather not let him know I'm from KC, see? I'm supposed to be from Cleveland." There's something kind of, maybe that's why he did it. There's something sort of nicely rhythmic about that, isn't there? Listen. "I'd rather not let him know I'm from KC, see?" There's something kind of hip-hoppy about it. I like it. And with that, he once more pressed Clyde's arm genially and looked him over. And Clyde, equally moved, added, "Sure, that's all right. I'm glad you were able to connect. My name's Tennant, Harry Tennant. Don't forget that." And both were radiantly happy because of old times' sake. Well, yeah, I mean, they're in a scrape together. You know, that poor girl gets killed, and it wasn't Ratterer's fault, and it wasn't Clyde's fault, but they were going to take the lumps, weren't they? All those guys and gals were going to take the lumps if they stayed there in KC. I mean, things weren't looking very good for them after they sped into the girl and then drove away and then left the scene of an accident. I mean, just trouble anywhere, any way you look at it, any way you slice it and dice it, they were in for some hot water. So, like Clyde, Ratterer got the hell out of Dodge, found his own way up to the Windy City, where he's working himself to the bone as a clerk of some sort, I guess for handkerchiefs and ties at the club. I mean, he's receiving deliveries and packages at the club. You understand what I'm saying? Sure you do. Hey, Shakespeare, you understand what I'm saying? Well, sure I do. That's my, you know, in all the years where I've been talking to Shakespeare, I never responded as Shakespeare. But that's my Shakespeare voice. Well, sure. Sure I do. All right, so they're happy because of old times' sake. But Ratterer, noticing Clyde's delivery uniform, observed, "Driving a delivery, eh? Gee, that's funny. You driving a delivery. Imagine, that kills me. What do you want to do that for?" Then seeing from Clyde's expression that his reference to his present position might not be the most pleasing thing in the world, since Clyde at once observed, "Well, I've been up against it, sorta," he added. "But say, I want to see you. Where are you living?" Clyde told him. "Well, that's all right. I get off here at 6. Why not drop around after you're through work? Or I'll tell you, suppose we meet at, well, how about Henrici's, H-E-N-R-I-C-I, Henrici's, on Randolph Street. Is that all right? That's 7, say. I get off at 6, and I can be over there by then if you can." "Yeah, just go to Henrici's, you know, get yourself a little rigotte and some shells and some veggie lasagna, the way your mama used to make it, with the nice mushrooms and the spinach and the rigotte and the mozzarella." Got veggie lasagna on the brain. Oh, Michael. Michael, you ever think of anything but your stomach? He boarded his wagon and continued his deliveries. Oh, he's got a wagon. And in my mind, I guess I thought he'd have a little car, but I guess not. Boarded his wagon and continued his deliveries. Yet for the rest of the afternoon, his mind was on this approaching meeting with Ratterer. And at 5:30, he hurried to his barn and then to his boarding house on the west side, where he donned his street clothes, then hastened to Henrici's. He'd not been standing on the corner a minute before Ratterer appeared, very genial and friendly, and dressed, if anything, more neatly than before. So, you know, looks like Ratterer's landed on his feet there in Chicago. He's probably still got the fancy stick pin and the striped trousers and the wingtip shoes, and who knows? You know, the cravat, the high collar, the fancy vest, the chinchilla socks. Oh, and then I said, "Socks," and what's the first word I see? Listen to this. "Gee, it's good to have a look at you, old socks," he began. That's another good one, old socks. Wow. "Do you know you're the only one of the bunch that I've seen since I left KC?" "That's right. My sister wrote me after we left home that no one seemed to know what became of either Higby or Heggy or you either. They sent that fella Sparser up for a year, did you hear that? Tough, eh? Not so much for killing the girl, but for taking the car and running it without a license and not stopping when signaled. That's what they got him for. But say, he lowered his voice most significantly at this point. We'd have got that if they'd got us. Oh, gee, I was scared. And run? And once more, he began to laugh, but rather hysterically at that. What a wallop, eh? And us leaving him and that girl in the car? Oh, say, tough, what? Just what else could a fella do, though? No need of all of us going up, eh? What was her name? Laura Sipe? And you cut out before I saw you, even. And that little Briggs girl's of yours did, too. Did you go home with her? Clyde shook his head negatively. I should say I didn't, he exclaimed. Well, where'd you go, then, he asked. Clyde told him. And after he had set forth a full picture of his own wayfarings, Ratterer returned with, Gee, you didn't know that little Briggs girl left with a guy from out there for New York right after that, did you? Some fella who worked in a cigar store, so Louise told me. She saw her afterwards, just before she left, with a new fur coat and all. Clyde winced sadly. Gee, but you were a sucker to fool around with her. She didn't care for you or nobody, but you was pretty much gone on her, I guess, eh? And he grinned at Clyde amusedly and chucked him under the arm in his old teasing way. I can imagine Clyde was not feeling particularly jovial at that particular observation of Ratterer's. Yeah, I mean, because he feels like a fool, does he not, particularly when he hears the detail of Hortense Briggs absconding with the little fur coat and on the arm of some jape in full flight for New York City, where they're going to start all over. Well, I mean, it was probably pretty tempting to think that Hortense Briggs is out of the story, you know, but apparently not, because if she's on the East Coast and Clyde's heading to the East Coast, I think we can assume their paths will cross again, probably when Clyde has made his mark in the business world and Hortense is looking to move her way up in the world. And I'm guessing that Clyde will be already on the arm of Bella with Myra causing trouble. Then Hortense comes in and further confuses the poor lad. And the next thing you know, he's made a mess of everything. And who knows? Who knows what happens after that? But I think you know what I'm rooting for. As always, murder-suicide. So let's take a break, and we will return in a moment here on Obscure.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Back in Obscure, I wish I was on some kind of Vicodin or something. They should just have Vicodin, you know, in bowls, the way some people keep hard candies. So you walk into somebody's house, you know, you got a little twinge in the back, you take a handful of Vicodin, next thing you know, you're feeling much better, or at the very worst, asleep, which is the same as feeling better, because who doesn't like to be asleep? Everybody likes that. So, it's Clyde and Ratterer, and they're catching up and seeing what the other's been up to in all this time. And He hears about Hortense heading out to New York. But in regard to himself, and this is Radwer talking, he proceeded to unfold a tale of only modest adventure, which was very different from the one Clyde had narrated. A tale, as he phrased, a tale which had less of nerves and worry and more of a sturdy courage and faith in his own luck and possibilities. And finally, he had caught on to this because, as he phrased it, you can always get something in Chi. C-H-I, short for Chicago. I don't know if that's how they would pronounce it, but Chi-Town, right? That's what they call Chicago, do they not? You can always get something in Chi. And here he had been ever since. Very quiet, of course, but no one had ever said a word to him. And forthwith he began to explain that just at present there wasn't anything in the Union League, but that he would talk to Mr. Haley, who was superintendent of the club, and that if Clyde wanted to, and Mr. Haley knew of anything, he would try and find out if there was an opening anywhere, or likely to be, and if so, Clyde could slip into it. But can that worry stuff, he said to Clyde toward the end of the evening, it don't get you nothing. Eh, wise words from Ratterer. Hey, Clyde, can all that worry and stuff, what's it going to get you other than a headache, kid? Hey, Shakespeare, what are you worried for?
Hey, whoa, what am I worried for? Well, gee, I ran over that girl in Kansas City.
I know you didn't, Shakespeare. That was Sparser, and he's doing a year for it. Calm down.
And then, only 2 days after this most encouraging conversation, and while Clyde was still debating whether he would resign his job, resume his true name, and canvass the various hotels in search of work, a note came to his room brought by one of the bellboys of the Union League, which read, "See Mr. Lighthall at the Great Northern before noon tomorrow. There's a vacancy over there. It ain't the very best, but it'll get you something better later." And accordingly, Clyde, after telephoning his department manager that he was ill and would not be able to work that day, made his way to this hotel in his very best clothes, and on the strength of what references he could give, was allowed to go to work, and much to his relief, under his own name. Also, to his gratification, his salary was fixed at $20 a month, meals included, but the tips, as he now learned, aggregated not more than 10 a week, yet that, counting meals, was far more than he was now getting as he comforted himself, and so much easier work, even if it did take him back into the old line, where he still feared to be seen and arrested. It was not so long after this, not more than 3 months, before a vacancy occurred in the Union League staff. Ratterer, having some time before established himself as day assistant to the club staff captain, and being on good terms with him, was able to say to the latter that he knew exactly the man for the place, Clyde Griffiths, then employed at the Great Northern, and accordingly, Clyde was sent for, and being carefully coached beforehand by Ratterer as to how to approach his new superior and what to say, he was given the place. All right, so in last week's episode, Clyde wrote to his mom and said, "Hey, I'm doing deliveries now. I'm not working in the hotel trade because it's a little too fast for a young man like me." But then he meets Ratterer, and 2 seconds later, he's got a job working at the hotel line. My dogs are going nuts over something. They always do this. When Martha stepped out, she has to run a couple of errands. The dogs get much barkier when she's not here, because what they do is they plant themselves by the front window to look out for her. And every person who goes by, they call out and they say, hey, are you Martha? Or do you know where she is? And then people say, I'm sorry, I'm not, and I don't. And they say, well, that's all right. We'll just keep asking people as they cross in front of our window. So that's what they're doing. They're just engaged in some convivial conversation with the folks on the street. But it's annoying. All right, so Clyde
now has got the place. And here, very different from the Great Northern and superior from a social and material point of view, as Clyde saw it, to even the Green Davidson, he was able once more to view at close range a type of life that most affected, unfortunately, his bump of position and distinction. For to this club, from day to day, came or went such a company of seemingly mentally and socially worldly elect as he had never seen anywhere before. Okay, listen to this. You've got basically four adverbs right in a row. Four out of five words are adverbs. A company of seemingly mentally and socially worldly elect. Jeez, that's a adverbial mouthful, is it not? I'll tell you who'd have a heart attack about that. Any contemporary writer, they all say the same thing. Get rid of the goddamn adverbs. And in general, I think that's good advice. But as we've seen, adverbs were in all the fashion 100 years ago. I don't know if it was a new technology or what, but people were dropping them left and right. And old Mr. Dreiser, no exception on that count. For to this club, from day to day, came or went such a company of seemingly mentally and socially worldly elect as he had never seen anywhere before. The self-integrated and self-centered from not only all of the states of his native land, but from all countries and continents. American politicians from the north, south, east, west, the principal politicians and bosses, or alleged statesmen of their particular regions, surgeons, scientists, arrived physicians, generals, literary and social figures, not only from America, but from the world over. Here also, a fact which impressed and even startled his sense of curiosity and awe even. There was no faintest trace of that sex element which had characterized most of the places of life to be seen in the Green Davidson and, more recently, the Great Northern. In fact, insofar as he could remember, had seemed to run through and motivate nearly, if not quite, all of the phases of life that he had thus far contacted. But here was no sex, no trace of it. No women were admitted to this club. These various distinguished individuals came and went, singly as a rule, and with the noiseless vigor and reserve that characterizes the ultra-successful. They often ate alone, conferred in pairs and groups noiselessly, read their papers or books, or went here and there in swiftly driven automobiles, but for the most part seemed to be unaware of, or at least unaffected by, that element of passion which to his immature mind, up to this time, had seemed to propel and disarrange so many things in those lesser worlds with which, up to now, he had been identified. Okay, again, that's another heck of a sentence. This one stretching 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines, beginning with, they often ate alone. So he's joined, he's become staff to what I guess is a men's social club of the finest stripe in one of America's premier cities, Chi-Town, Chicago, Illinois. And it is there that he is seeing a different side of the moneyed class, the more serious side, the pensive side. There he is among the world's, or the whole world's elite. And he is seeing them somewhat differently than he saw the clientele at the Green Davidson and the Great Northern. Now, that is making me somewhat change my opinion on the Green Davidson, but maybe that's unfair because that was a public hotel in which men and women would cavort quite naturally. I don't think it was particularly a den of iniquity. It's just that in the hotel trade, where you're going to have men and women mixing, well, there's going to be some mixing of men and women. And I think that's what they're getting to. But the larger point seems to be that there is a different category of person once you get to the level of the ultra successful. At the Green Davidson in Great Northern, perhaps Clyde had merely been associating with the pedestrian successful, those personages of upper middle and lower upper classes who, you know, maybe get in their cups a little bit too much and go pinwheeling around the dance floor with girls of uncertain morals, whereas there at the Union Club, there is no time for such frivolities or nonsense. No, these captains of industry, these military men, these politicians and literary figures are far too busy, far too wrapped up in their work to bother with the carnal pleasures of city life. These are people of great import. Probably one could not attain to or retain one's place in so remarkable a world as this unless one were indifferent to sex, a disgraceful passion, of course. And hence, in the presence or under the eyes of such people, one had to act and seem as though such thoughts, as from time to time swayed one, were far from one's mind. Well, one thing that we know in our time, here in the early years of the 21st century, we know that that idea of the moneyed class being a superior class is utter nonsense. If anything, money gives you license to indulge in the worst excesses of your imaginings. You can procure anything you want, and so people do. Often in the most lascivious of terms. After he had worked here a little while, under the influence of this organization and various personalities who came here, he had taken on a most gentlemanly and reserved air. When he was within the precincts of the club itself, he felt himself different from what he really was, more subdued, less romantic, more practical, certain that if he tried now, imitated the soberer people of the world, and those only, that some day he might succeed, if not greatly, at least much better than he had thus far. And who knows, what if he worked very steadily, and made only the right sort of contacts, and conducted himself with the greatest care here? One of these very remarkable men whom he saw entering or departing from here might take a fancy to him and offer him a connection with something important somewhere, such as he had never had before, and that might lift him into a world such as he had never known. For to say the truth, Clyde had a soul that was not destined to grow up. He lacked decidedly that mental clarity and inner directing application that in so many permits them to sort out from the facts and avenues of life the particular thing or things that make for their direct advancement. What an interesting little aside from Dreiser there at the end of the chapter. We have concluded chapter 22. But why does Dreiser feel it necessary to interject that little aside that Clyde is missing a kind of lack of mental clarity that people who are more destined for success possess? I guess Dreiser is saying he is the kind of person who needs to rely on the kindness of strangers to make his way in the world. In that way, he is sort of, he's sort of like Blanche DuBois. And who was Blanche DuBois most like? Well, of course, Lindsey Graham. No one can say that Lindsey Graham is not a success. However, what Lindsey Graham, perhaps like Clyde Griffiths, possesses is that lack of mental clarity which the truly great all seem to have. Those men and women who make their own way in the world unattached to the coattails of others. And Clyde, it seems like, is destined to be a coattail rider, as per Theodore Dreiser. I mean, he's sort of envisioning himself the way I think I did when I was like an extra when I first started. You know, I did a couple days here and there being an extra for various things. And the sad hope of the extra is that they will be noticed, that they will be marked as somehow different from the other extras on the film set. Perhaps they will be given a line or some bit of business to call attention to themselves. And of course, it so rarely happens, if ever. And it's not going to happen with Clyde. We already know this. Instead, he's going to rely on being a little nepo baby. Are you not, Clyde? A little nepo baby. In the service of your patron, your Uncle Samuel. But all of that is to come, probably in the next chapter, on the next episode. So we'll leave it there for now. We'll pick it up again on another parasitic episode of Obscure. But until then, I wish you adieu.
This season of Obscure is produced by me, Michael Ian Black, and Robin Lynn. Our theme music is by Craig Wedren. If you listen and like the show, please help us out with a rating and a review. We want to be obscure, but not that obscure. It's an easy way to support the show. Thanks.